Oh, hey. this is Evan Matthews. We're about to unspool a new version. Not a new version. A new episode of the Mythmakers podcast here, focused on a new series on Macroverse called Dame Yaga. We're going to do an official kind of introduction to the guests and talk about that series as part of the episode. But I am experimenting with a little shameless plug here at the beginning of the episode. As many of you know, we have built and are rolling out, or have rolled out, what we believe the future of comics and graphic novels are on our Macroverse app, the Macroverse platform, if you will. We're super excited about it. We think it's super awesome, and we want you to check it out. We want you to love it. We want you to rate it. We want you to review it. We want you, most of all, to tell people about it, because honestly, we think we nailed it. So check it out for yourselves. Download the Macroverse app for iOS or Android. There are links in the show notes. And then read Dame Yaga, which is one of the latest series to come out on that app. It is the future of what comics need to be. It's the future that we believe supports the creators in a way that is sustainable and really supports the ecosystem for fans, creators, publishers, kind of the whole 360 of what comics are and need to be. Check it out.
Adam.
Evan, how are you?
I'm good. How are you? Well, as our guest today just said, as well as could reasonably be expected in the given circumstances. So,
exactly.
Yes. So welcome back to another episode of Mythmakers. This is a podcast all about storytelling and the people and process that do that. And then this is a special edition in our Makerverse series where we talk to people that we're working with who are making stuff for Macroverse. So to just dive right in, today we're talking to Andrew Trebold and Jeff Bartel, who are the masterminds and creative force behind the Dame Yaga series, which launched about a week ago on the platform. And first of all, we love it, but say hi, you guys.
Hey, how's it going, everybody?
Hi, Jeff Bartel here. Happy to be here. Excited to talk about it. I'm really excited about this project.
Awesome.
That's brilliant.
We certainly are as well.
Oh, yeah.
So, I mean, just for anyone that doesn't know you guys, I mean, just somebody go first, but give a little background on kind of who you are, what you're working on, and kind of how you came to this point in your journey, but also how that kind of brought us to Dame Yaga.
You want to go first, Jeff, or should I? It's up to you.
Why don't you go first? You're super more interesting than me.
Okay. Well, so I started Dame Yaga. It was actually about like a year ago where I asked Jeff to write Dame Yaga for me. And he was nice enough to say yes. And then, while he was doing that, I talked to you and you mentioned, you know, you contacted me about the Macroverse and if I had any series in mind, and I thought, hey, there's a series I had in mind. And that's just kind of, and then we got the ball rolling and then we got it on the app. So
here we are. Yeah.
Yeah. And here we are.
Andy, can you talk a little bit about your background?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
You know,
sorry.
How you reached your...
my background in art or...
Yes. All of it.
Okay. So I went to college for illustration. And then I graduated and I kind of thought like, well, what next? You know, what do I do now? And it was a while ago. So this was kind of like before video games were like really a thing and they were a thing, but not a lot of people worked in them. And the general idea was that, well, you have to be a programmer to work in video games. And anyway, long story short, I wound up getting a job at a place called Raven Software in Madison. And I worked there for about 8 years and as a texture artist. And then I moved out to California. I worked there for about 7 years at various companies. I don't know if any of your viewers know this, but I worked on Firefall and then, what's the name of it? Wildstar. There we go. Mm-hmm. Two MMOs. And now I work in Atlanta at Hi-Rez Studios as a staff artist. Yeah. And I also do a lot of like illustration and stuff on the side and, you know, do my own projects like Dame Yaga. Mm-hmm. And yeah, that's pretty much where I am right now.
Fantastic.
Yeah. So, yeah, Jeff, you wanna take the reins here?
Yeah. Okay. So my background. So I'm actually gonna tie Andy into my background because he's a huge part of me in comics. I was always a big reader, but I never really read much in the way of comic books until I would have been like my last senior year of high school. Right around that time, I became friends with Andy, and he was really into comic books. And honestly, at that point, I think I had an issue of G.I. Joe, an issue of like the Transformers, and like a couple of Archies, and that was it. And it just did not hit my radar at all. And Andy was talking to me about like, hey, there's some really good comics. I was like, I don't think that's
I don't know, Andy.
No. So he looked under very, very careful like orders. He's like, all right, I'm going to give you Arkham Asylum. But you have got to be careful with it. Like, I want this thing coming back the way that I'm giving it to you. Like, and you know,
oh so god, anyways, I'd like to apologize for anything I would have said back then, because horrible of me.
Yeah, anyway, the point being is, he at another point, gave me two long boxes just full of comics and just indefinitely, and just said, just check these out. So, point being is, he really introduced me to comics as being something that just at that point became very interesting to me. Got hugely, I was lucky enough right at that same time period, Sandman came out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, I had the great experience of like, issue by issue of Sandman and
that kind of hit. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Oh no, please.
I was just going to say right that kind of hit right where, cause like we were about 20 ish, I think around that time. Mm-hmm. And so it kind of hit at just the right time, like in in our age group, like where, like, when you're kind of out of the house and you're looking for something kind of newer and, different, like I think everybody kind of seeks for that. And that was happening in comics. That's like right when Vertigo started happening.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And right when, I always call it like first wave Vertigo, where it was like, where it was really impactful. Like there was Alan Moore's Swamp Thing, Sandman, a ton of stuff by Peter Milligan. And all that was coming out. And so I think that just hit us at just the right time. So, Jeff, go ahead.
No problem. So just to move forward, my career always had kind of two paths. I was very interested in comics. I was very interested in editing video. Mm-hmm. Those are the two places. And I was an intern at Fantagraphics for about a year, which that's true. I was about a year out in Seattle. Very interesting experience. Met a lot of really great, interesting people. But I sort of reached a point in my life where it was going to go in one of two directions, and I decided to go into broadcast. So from that point on, I've worked in broadcast TV in Green Bay. Started off at the NBC affiliate. Now I transferred over to the WB affiliate, which became the CW affiliate. And I've actually been with that WB/CW affiliate since 2003. So like, that channel has sort of been my my career from that point forward. We've been friends again, going back to high school. We've always, touched base, and we've talked about doing projects over the years. We recently wrapped one project, and he had been talking about Dame Yaga for, several years. This is, this is something that has definitely been percolating for a while. And he, occasionally would send me like, I've got this, what do you think? And, we just sort of touch base about it. But like you said earlier, it was about, I would say November of not last year, but the year before, where he, came to me and said, the writing, I'm having a hard time with this. Can you help me out? And, that's really where this thing, started to kick off.
Yeah, it was definitely like, I'm very grateful to have Jeff to write. And because he's a writer, I'm not really a writer, I'm an artist. And, I found that like, I don't know things like, story structure and like character development and all that. I mean, I know them, in a general sense, but I just think that you'd really need to have a specialist be doing this. Like, I know, I think it's interesting, like when you're trying to tell a story as an artist, because we concentrate on sort of the glory moments, like you'll find that happens in writing also. Like you want to, you want to make a glory moment every other page. And it's like, well, no, it's just a different monster when you're doing, you know, with writers and, and plus like it keeps it fresh because then I can be surprised with what he's doing with the script. You know, like I don't know every word and then have to go back and draw every word that I just wrote down. So,
Yeah, that's interesting. And I have a couple of follow up questions for both of you there, but it just makes me think of, so, you know, it's like I also have a illustration background and kind of started more on the visual side of things and then have done a lot more writing over the past, handful of years. And what I find for me, which is, I think, not true for a lot of people that have some level of both of those skill sets, is like I can't focus on telling the, like, you know, kind of like I have to wear one hat or the other. It's like if I'm you know, it's like if I'm focused on the kind of the story and the structure and the characters, it's like I can't really be drawing that at the same time. And I also find that like if I'm trying to like draw something, like the story piece kind of falls away. So it's like I've got to kind of like put one hat on or the other, whereas there are, you know, certainly other writer artists who, you know, really do kind of figure it out on the page simultaneously. And I don't quite have that brain.
God bless them. I mean, that's a great skill to have. It's just not one that I really have. And it's something that, like, in my own, like, in my art and things like that, like, recently within the past couple of years, I've decided to only concentrate on things that, like, that I want to do, if that makes sense. Like, I think a lot of artists feel like, well, I need to do, you know, I need to be a painter, or I need to be like this other artist, or I need to, you know, it's like, well, you know, I've recently discovered, like, I'm more of a draftsman than I am a painter. And I was painting for years, and I think, like, I produce some decent stuff, but, like, I just enjoy drawing more. Like, it's just like kind of where I am artistically and creatively. So I think like just sort of accepting those limitations and then just sort of concentrating on what you're good at and just really becoming, you know, like really concentrating on that instead of trying to split your, you know, your time and ability through all these different things. So.
Right. Well, it's, I mean, that brings, that makes me spark to you. I have a question for you, Jeff, momentarily, but that makes me think of too, it's like, you know, this podcast in general tends to be about kind of storytelling and the process of storytelling. We try to keep things kind of focused on that because it's a big part of what we're interested in and interested in kind of different viewpoints on. And one of the things that, you know, Adam and I have come to in our work together over the past decade is kind of looking at, you know, how do you make the things that you're working on, you know, where, especially from a kind of format perspective or from a approach perspective, like how do you take the things that are perceived as weaknesses and make those things strengths? And a lot of that is, I think, kind of, you know, at least it resonates for me in that sense of, you know, kind of leaning into those things that you're really good at or really passionate about, or, you know, it's a conversation we have kind of ongoingly about how do you find your voice? And I think that applies to visual art, to the written word, to, you know, all those things. I mean, so many people are kind of focused on like, what's my style? How do I find my style? How do I find my voice? And, you know, I think that, you know, my belief around that is that it's like, you know, you can't really go searching for it. It's the thing that develops by doing the process.
Absolutely.
By doing the thing. And the, you know, if you're trying to force it, you know, going one way or the other, that it's never really you, it's just some amalgam of other people. And so I think, you know, it's cool for me. You know, I came across your work, you know, a handful of years ago, when we made some stickers,
I remember those.
for iMessage.
I still send them to people like here and there.
Absolutely. So I came across your work, I think just randomly on Behance or something, and, you know, really liked it. And, you know, we had approached you about doing that, and we made those, which I believe are also still on the App Store for anybody who wants them. You know, it was interesting to me to kind of see, you know, having seen a little bit of the evolution of kind of what you were doing then to what you're now doing with Dame Yaga. And then at some point in there, I think you showed me some other pages that you were working on, which had a much more kind of heavily Mignola kind of vibe, you know, to them.
Well, I had originally started, I think, did I show you other Dame Yaga? Like, because I had started,
you know,
this before.
Yeah, it may have been, because it definitely had a, you know, kind of similar tone to it, but I think felt stylistically much more kind of Mignola-esque, you know, if you will. So, I mean, my point in all of that is, like, you know, it's been really cool to kind of see those touch points, you know, kind of along the way. And it feels like what you're doing now, I mean, just to bring it back around and fan out on you as an illustrator for a second.
Well, thank you.
You know, it feels like what you're doing now, like it does feel like, oh, this is like coming from a pretty fully formed, you know, creative point of view. Like you're doing something that feels like, you know, this, it at least comes across to me like, oh, this is you doing something that you really feel passionate about.
Well, thanks, man. Yeah. I mean, a lot of it, I'm sorry, I interrupted you. Sorry.
No, go ahead. Go ahead.
I was just going to say a lot of that is because I have Jeff like adding things to it. Like, I mean, I gave him like the bones of the idea, but he's just taking it and running with it and really filling it out. And that in turn helps the artwork and the style. And like, you know, there's a lot of things that he's putting in there that I just never would have considered. And I think that's part of like, you know, when you are creating with another person, they're going to add kind of like they're going to add their DNA to it. There's just no way around it. And it just really filled out the idea a lot more. So.
Absolutely. I mean, that's evident. It's a good collaboration.
I was going to ask, what is that process between the two of you? So obviously, Andrew, said kind of your idea, and you came to you went to Jeff with the kind of bones of the concept, and then how did that then develop into what it is now?
I pretty much just had the idea and a general outline, but one thing I wanted to do is like I didn't want to. I just said like this is what I want. This is kind of like what happens, and then Jeff just took it and ran with it. And which is awesome because he's turned it into something that I never could have. And it's pretty much just like, here are the bones, like kind of do what you want with it. Cause I think Jeff and I are very stylistically aligned. Like, I think like, I know like basically back from the comic days, there's been, I can probably count on one hand the number of comics we've disagreed on, like in terms of like, of them being awesome or not, you know? So it's like, I know pretty much that anything he recommends to me is going to be cool. Same with movies, same with music, things like that. So I was pretty like, and also there's, I didn't want it to be like I really wanted to stress the idea that, you know, that look, the writing is your thing. You know, I don't want to be in a position of like dictating or micromanaging and just saying like, you know, look, this is your thing. We're partners. You're telling the story. I'm just going to do the art, you know, and this is a collaboration, not like a, anything else. Right. So.
And then, I mean, kind of following up to that, then, absolutely. Jeff, detailed are you getting on the page with the art direction, with the directorial part of creating comics, which is always something that we enjoy?
Oh, right. Yeah. Well, I'm just going to take one step back. Andy and I, we had a couple of sort of long conversations, and I took notes on them. And he also sent me a couple of emails with follow-up things. So, you know, the genesis of this was there were certain things that these were ideas that were very, very clear and very strong in his head that were, you know, like this is, you know, I think he always had a very, like, he knew who Dame Yaga, in this particular instance, Elizabeth, is, you know, one of the things that's a challenge is that we have quite a bit of the story written. You know, and so we're only, you know, a little bit into what we've told the audience. I'm going to try to be mindful of that as I'm
Maybe some minor spoiler alerts, but let's save the big reveals
I'll be in it. Obviously, thank God you can edit in case I say something.
Yeah.
Anyway, so he gave me some very, very clear ideas. And then for me, what it really was a question of was kind of a, problem solving. Like, okay, it's the intersection of this, you know, somewhat aristocratic British lady and this very Russian-based folklore figure, you know, and they had to meet some way. To me, Baba Yaga does not work in London, just doesn't. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, I don't see that working there. There's no rule against it. She could, and in fact, you know, but like that's not how they meet. They're just, to my mind, that could not work. So therefore, and the time period was World War One. That was, you know, it was like 19. I think he had initially said 1920. I'm mentally putting it earlier.
It's 1915 now. Logistics. Yeah,
yeah, basically, yeah, start of the war. Mm-hmm. So that put it to me like, all right, we got to get her to Europe, which is you're in the middle of World War One. So World War One, I don't think was necessarily initially a part of what Andy had talked to me about, but it just made sense. And then that became, how do we get her to World War One? She's, you know, as a female, you're not a soldier. You're never going to be a soldier. Yeah. And there's only certain ways you can be there. And I'll freely confess, I didn't want her to be a nurse for multiple reasons, but not the least of which, I just didn't want to have to fake knowing anything about how to heal anything. I just didn't want to do it, man. I mean, when you watch ER, I am sure they have somebody whose job is, all right, you fill in the dialogue that makes this doctor sound like they know what they're talking about.
Oh, the medical consultant. Yeah.
Many. Yeah.
Yeah. So I didn't want to do that. But, doing just a bit of research, I found how to do it, which was to make her an ambulance driver. And that is an absolute thing that is really fascinating.
Yeah.
I mean, the thing is there's going to be, when I first started writing, and for the first large portion of writing it, a lot of what you're going to be reading, it has a very deliberate feel, and it is not one that is very historically grounded at this time. That's not what it's there to do. Mm-hmm. It is exactly the story I wanted to tell, and the aspects that I've found as I've done the research and as I've really immersed myself into the world of the ambulance driving and the world of World War One, that is going to emerge as the world opens up more. And there's just, it is in a weird way. When you talk about things like fairyland or Wonderland, when you talk about these sort of set fictional spaces, there's a feel and there's touch points to them, but there's another worldliness, of course. World War One, in its place in history, feels like one of those spaces. There's so many things about it that are they really just don't feel like, in a very, very real way, there are straight through lines of things that happened in World War One that reverberate today that are clear to see. You can see them. If you look for them, they're right there. But at the same time, it's a completely forgotten war. Nobody thinks about it.
Well, I want to apologize to everybody for my interruptions.
This is me and Adam.
I was just going to say that, you're talking about the Wonderland aspect. I think it's interesting because there is sort of I always felt that, and I think Jeff and I had talked about this, there was kind of a meeting of the old world and new world kind of colliding in World War One, especially in that era. And when you look at it, when you do the research just on all of the things they were trying, they were just throwing everything at the wall. Everything was jury-rigged. Everything made no sense. Everything was I saw some old gas masks. I saw old uniforms, and everything had this horrifying look to it. That everything was clunky and just had kind of a strange past meets future. And this is kind of where there's the changeover. And it's interesting too, having a woman in that time, a human being meeting something from the folklore that's also representative of that, of those two eras kind of colliding with one another.
Yeah.
So
absolutely. And I do want to make one more quick point. When I say fantasy or Wonderland with World War One, something that I also am very mindful of is just, the reality of it, and just the you can't wrap your mind around how tragic that war was. How many people died? And, with World War II, you can point to, this is the good that came of it. We killed Nazis. Nazism was stopped. It's a very clear, hey, the good guys won in a way that is very clear cut. At the end of World War One, it just stopped.
Yeah. And really World War One did was make World War II. I mean, when you really think about it.
World War II. Yeah, exactly. It just set up the sequel.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It was literally, really, that's all it was good for. Yeah. But anyway.
Yeah. Yeah. but I do want to be very mindful, like, that's something that's important to me, that, you know, as much as there is this absolute, you know, like the mix of the old and new, which is really very important to me. Another part of it is that, you know, and I really hope to do this through Elizabeth. Like, this is people just like you and me in this extraordinary situation that does not make sense. And what you do, and in a way, like, you know, the horror of World War One is bad enough. You really don't need to add monsters. Like, there's enough horrible there. Like, in a way, like, I guess, all right, minor spoiler, there may or may not be monsters coming up. But, like, nobody is particularly...
There may or may not.
Because it's like, that's one more fucking thing. Yeah, it would be. Right, mustard gas, sure, throw that in there. My feet are literally rotting off. And just chuck monsters in. Why not? Another reason for me not to get
non-human monsters. Yes, let's be clear.
yeah, exactly.
So that's, you know, it really does have this absolutely like, where it's coming from, the ground it's coming from, there's it's really just this singular place to be coming from, and I'm really excited about it. It's just fascinating.
Yeah, it's a lot.
No, it's really cool. Yeah. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, it's just a really fun area to explore too, like, artistically. Like, there's just the thing that I've been noticing lately, and like, you'll notice through the comic, is that how, well, two things. One kind of unrelated, a small aside, if anybody listening wants to look up ambulance drivers in World War One, there is a ton of information, and there's a ton of really cool photos of all of these brave women who were just in, like, doing all of this. And they probably just, like, spent their time trying to save people, and then they went home and never talked about it again. And it's amazing. I had no idea that there was an ambulance corps or whatever they called it. Like, I have no idea that there was, like, all of these people doing this. But it's just kind of cool. And also, they produced a lot of interesting images. There's one in particular I saw where I don't know if they were actually in a prisoner's camp or if they were just, like, in their own. But if they were basically behind barbed wire, and they were all just kind of smiling and laughing at the camera. And it's that kind of, like, you know, this can't beat us either type of, you know, spirit, like, conveyed in the picture that I thought was really cool. So, I mean, if you happen to find it, it's pretty cool. But I forgot my other point. But go ahead.
Do you guys have, I mean, if there are any links to that stuff, that sounds awesome. We'd love to throw them in the show notes.
Yeah, absolutely. I have it on my
stuff that you guys have been pulling.
I have it on my Pure Ref. I can send it to you.
Yeah. 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 That sounds awesome.
One thing I want to, for anybody that's going to go down this road, I think we all have a strong appreciation of the importance of, like, a good name for things. Mm-hmm. You know, like Avatar, that sounds cool. You know, there's certain things that just, so God bless the women who volunteered to drive ambulances in World War One. But this needs to be noted. Okay, so there was a couple of them that did that volunteering work. Red Cross was certainly one, and hey, that's a great name, Red Cross. God bless you guys.
Yeah.
the one of the ones that did it, it's an acronym. So the name of it was the First Aid Nursing Yeomanry.
Fanny.
And it's Fanny.
Fanny.
So unfortunately, I would say this is one of those things that's, it's just you have to get over this because, Fanny is one of the big names when you're talking about World War One, and unfortunately, it is a bit of a thing to overcome. Because
but you can't tell me. But you can't tell me they didn't plan that. You can't tell me they didn't. They weren't searching for words to spell out Fanny. Like, how are we going to make this be Fanny?
I just wish I feel like this could have been avoided.
Yeah, exactly. Like, that's what I said. It could have, but they didn't. They didn't want to. They wanted to be called Fanny.
Right. So in any case, Fanny, and the reason I bring that up is, in terms of resources, something I'd strongly recommend. There's a book, it's for free on Amazon. You can just, because it's past the, the copyright expiration thing. It's the story, the true story of a woman who did, went over to World War, she went over to the front lines as an ambulance driver. When she first went over there, it was so early they were doing a horse-drawn ambulance.
Yeah.
And while she was there, it transitioned over into vehicles. Now, she knew that it was going to be, like, her training. They trained her on the automobile. But, like, that was, like, she was a transitional thing with that. And the reason I preface the entire Fanny thing is the name of the book is Fanny Goes to War. It's by Pat Buchamp. And it's fantastic. I mean, it's a really great read. I mean, I really recommend it highly. Like, it's just, you know, some people, you know, when you read some of the stuff from, like, the 10s and 20s, it can get a little over verbose and, you know, just a hell of a lot of words. What I did, like, this read really easily. There is a lot of, like, terminology that is just lost at time. I mean, she'll use nicknames for things that, it's just gone. Like, you'll reference what is this thing, and it'll reference the book because that's the only place anybody's heard of it.
Or they'll give you a sentence where they use it, and you have to figure it out, like, from the context of the sentence.
Yeah.
But it is phenomenal. Like, it's phenomenal. She's so positive. She's so upbeat about the whole thing, and you only find out, this is a fairly major spoiler, but I think it's worth mentioning. She is hit by a bomb while in her in a vehicle. And she ends up losing a leg, and that comes up 3/4 of the way through the book. Like, like that, she's like, oh, and then I had this happen. Like, most people I feel would lead with, hey, you know how I have one leg?
Yeah.
And this is how it happened.
Yeah. Let me get into it.
Right.
Yeah. But, like, you know, like, she's talking about, when she's talking about her training and her days over there, it's so positive and it's focused on the people she met. And there's no, like, foreshadowing of, like, little did I know that when I walked to my car, that this the last time I would be using one foot with the other to move places.
It is sort of like an old time or maybe an older generation thing of just kind of like, you just deal with it, you know, like, and I mean, because you just didn't have a choice. It's like, well, you know, you can lay in this ditch and die, or you can get up and walk away. You know, it's just like, and it is that type of attitude, like, that people rise to in war or in difficult times, that I find really interesting. And I think relates really well to the main character. You know, she's somebody who is just kind of rising above because she can. And that's what I really like about the character. So,
yeah.
She's very much, she has somebody of very, like, she has very strong, she has a very strong moral compass. She's got a high ideal, and that's something that I think is very much in keeping with that particular time period, because it is a time where they went to war with a very idealized vision of war. You know, it was a time, this is the introduction of the machine gun. And so those early days, that's the thing. It's not just the early days. Through much of World War I, they just didn't quite know how to go about doing what they were doing.
It was the first modern war.
So deep into into the war, as an example, one of their main injuries and causes of death is people would just poke their head up out of the trench to look and see what was going, and they just get shot.
Yeah, right.
You know, and that happened.
Well, and remember, like, you were talking about the buggies, like, how she was, or the cars that she was trained on a car, but they gave her a buggy. It's like, so they had to build the cars. Like, it's almost like they didn't have enough cars on backlog to give her to drive. So they're like, well, you're just going to be using a buggy for now, and we'll get you a car in a month or two. Because we're building them as we're fighting this war. That's how new and weird this war was. And like Jeff said, they didn't, I mean, I think, Jeff, at one point we were having a discussion where there were people still fighting on horseback with swords, and they charged a German embankment, and obviously they all died because
they just got
because it was just like, well, we don't know how else to do this, so we're just gonna try this, and it failed. It's interesting, like how it, again, like that whole idea of like the old meeting the new. Like, you still have men who are using swords to fight, but then, like, a lot of the times I have to look up, like, well, did they have machine guns? Did they, you know, like, there's still men on horseback, but they also have motorcycles. You know, it's like, just not a lot of them. So it's a very interesting time, and it's very, so
it's a really interesting, it's a really interesting mashup. It's funny, it's like, you know, it's like I think probably for a lot of people, and certainly me included, it's like World War II has become so storied and almost mythical, you know, in the way that it's been portrayed across all kinds of media, and World War I doesn't quite have that same level of cultural, you know, kind of prevalence.
But as you guys are talking, it's like, you know, it's reminding me of like, you know, what a interesting, weird, you know, time and place that is, and what a great, you know, kind of background for any kind of story to kind of play against. Just because of all of that, you know, kind of fascinating.
Bizarre.
It's the inevitable process when the generation of four people has all died and their children are now old, it doesn't occupy the same space. So I think in another 30 or 40 years, World War II will be filling that same thing. Because it'll be World War I will then be like the Boer War or the Napoleonic War.
Yeah.
It'll just have that, you know?
Yeah.
Well, I wonder part of that though is exactly what you guys said early on, that, you know, there's an actual kind of mythology around World War II. It plays so directly into our, you know, kind of the just storytelling tropes that kind of occupy most of our content with, you know, there's a good guy and there's a bad guy, and you know, there's a real kind of just mythology around it, where I think, you know, people have you know, been fascinated by that kind of real life, you know, heroes and villains kind of setup. And, you know, you're still seeing TV shows made, you know, set in World War II, and movies set in World War II. And, you know, and you know, 1917 aside, there's very little that seems to be, you know, kind of looking back to those earlier conflicts.
Yeah. And another thing that's very interesting to me is, like, so I was watching, I mean, believe it or not, I'll admit it, I was watching Downton
Abbey. You say that like it's a bad thing.
And, I gotta be careful about who I out myself to, so that, you know, I was, you know, but they had some of the nobility, like the people who, I don't know if they're called nobility or whatever, the rich people in Downton Abbey, some of them are coming back from the war, and it's interesting the attitudes of class in relevance to the war. Like, you were expected to serve in the war. Like, if you were of the upper class, at least that's the impression that I got. Like, and if it was sort of poor form if you didn't. And that it's a big change from, I mean, they also did in World War II. But, you know, I mean, nowadays, like, you know, the common social trope is that the rich kid gets posted in Alaska with the Coast Guard, while, you know, to keep him safe. It's just an interesting, like, it was an interesting sociological thing of, like, and it ties in well with Elizabeth, because she is, I don't think she's strictly, she's nobility, but it's not sort of like a princess or anything like that. She's, you know, one of the, she's an aristocrat. Yeah. She has some meaningless title, and like, and she has land somewhere, but for the most part, you know, she's of the upper class, and she is, so it ties in well that she would be expected to serve, you know, and it's just a very interesting kind of paradigm shift from what we see today.
Interesting. So World War I did also have the unique thing to kind of exactly what you're talking about, with this kind of educated upper class going and serving in these horrendous conditions. And so you had the World War I poetry coming out of England, which is unique in its look at war, because you had these massively educated men having this insight and able to express themselves in ways that I think hasn't happened in quite the same way, certainly not with poetry. Obviously, plenty of novels written, but the World War I poetry occupying its own kind of unique literary slot, you know?
Yeah.
Well, and of course, you know, if hopefully there won't be another one, but, you know, if there ever is another conflict like that, it'll all be done in 128 characters.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah. It's
quite a change. It always makes me think.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. I mean, if you've ever seen the Ken Burns Civil War series, which I think is just, you know, unbelievably great, if you haven't, or but there's a portion of that documentary series where they're reading letters from the you know, soldiers sent back home, and on the flip side of that, I mean, a lot of them are coming from the poorest of the poor, you know, out there, you know, serving either on the north or the south, and it's the most eloquent, you know, stuff you've ever heard.
Right.
It's like, this has been lost.
Well, there's still eloquence, but I wanted to jump back on what you were saying about the poetry, because I did look into that. And there is some really spectacular stuff. I just wanted, here's an example I had pulled. I don't, just as a sort of a mental touch point, this is by somebody who served in World War I. It's a poem called Exposure, and the opening line is, "Northward, incessantly, The flickering gunnery rumbles far off like a dull rumor of some other war. What are doing here? And yeah, just like those couple of lines, it continues from there, but I read that and I was just, it sort of like just punched me in the gut because there it is right there. Just like, what are we doing here?
Wilfred Owen and Siegfried Sassoon particularly, I think.
Well, Jeff,
had produced some of the most memorable stuff in that time. And also questioning patriotism in a way that I think was new as well. You know, very, very interesting stuff. And again, just come back to an incredible backdrop against which to tell this story.
Yeah.
And Jeff, go ahead, please.
No, go ahead. I'm about to try to segue. So go ahead.
I'll put a button on this by saying, ideals and idealism is something that is very much a part of the story. So that is something that I think is one of the core things that we're exploring with it. You were about to segue.
Yeah. So I think it's just a kind of an add-on or a tangent to that is, I think getting into the kind of craft side of this for both of you guys. So one of the things I noticed, Jeff, in your scripts that we've seen so far, I mean, there's a real kind of attention to and peculiarity in the best possible way, kind of attention to language and the way that specific words are used or the way that, the different characters, kind of their voices and the way they talk. And I just love for you to kind of talk a little bit about, both in terms of this story where you can without giving too many spoilers, but also just as a writer, kind of, where does that come from for you? Or how do you think about kind of using those tools as a way to kind of reinforce the narrative and the story that you're trying to tell?
I'll answer that in two ways. One of which was one of my jobs at Fantagraphics when I was there was transcribing interviews. So I'd get like a long interview with I'm trying to remember some of the people like Kurt Busiek I transcribed. And one of the things that was very important to me when I was transcribing was the way people talk, the cadence of it, to capture sort of the rhythm of it. Like I do a lot of dot, dot, dots because you do get these like pauses, where people interrupt themselves like I just did. That sort of thing. So that's something that, like, because I did a lot of that, that made me really focus on how people talk. And I found that very interesting. So that's part of it. Something I can say that, and this is, one of the many, many reasons I love working with Andy is I'm actually not a particularly visual guy. Mm. Like, I don't necessarily, when I create something, I can give a description, but like, I know there's people that see things like this, there's the way that they experience the world is incredibly visual. And I wouldn't say that that's necessarily true for me. Not that I don't, see things, but when I hear, with something like, say, the voice of Elizabeth, it's almost, I guess you could almost say it's like a frequency that I tune into. That sounds very, I guess, a little pretentious, maybe. It's one of those things that's very hard to describe, but I could imagine, a scenario where somebody could actually like see a cinematic scene where they can like, all right, she's going to be here talking like this. And for me, it's just more of an instinctual feel thing that what feels right. It's always sort of like it has a feeling where like, yes, I'm in this particular mode and this works within this particular mode. That's it. Or like, this isn't a spoiler, but especially like the voice of young Yaga, I think is something where it just has this, again, it's kind of like a note where, where you have, like when you play a chord, you can have discords where it works within the other notes and it creates a mood. But if you do something where it's just a real plunk, it's gone. Mm-hmm. She has a very specific note tone that, like, that's one of the things that was interesting to me as I was writing is, should I put her in here? Does it make sense to? And the answer is sometimes yes. And I never wanted to force it, but it was like it was one of the most interesting. Her voice in that thing is one of the most interesting ones of all of them to write. Also because it's a dark thing in many ways. And yet she's like not oblivious to it, but she's a child, it's not something that she engages with emotionally at all.
Yeah. Well, there's an innocence to it. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Well, it's not even innocence is a word that I think is easy to, like, you know, you can say it and have a meaning, but like what that means in this particular instance is that she knows the stuff on a basically the intellectual level, like she's heard it. And so she knows this, but she, you know, part of what she's doing and what kids do when they ask these questions again and again and again is they don't get it. They do not get it. And so they're trying to get this, like, they're just trying to wrap their head around it, but they can't, you know, engage certain parts of it because they're just not there yet. They're not developed enough yet. So, and so that's one of the things that's really fascinating to me with it. Yeah. So I don't know. So to answer your question that you were saying is one of it is like, I'm very mindful of cadence. And the other one is just, I guess, for lack of a better way of putting it, is the way that particular note, does that sound right with these other notes that I'm playing?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it really does function that way. And I think especially when you marry that with the visuals, like you guys are doing one of my favorite things in comics where you're kind of doing two things simultaneously that could be separate but are making something greater than the sum of their parts by being together, which I think is, you know, one of the things that comics does better than just about any other medium is, you know, kind of the combination of word and image in a way that, you know, other things don't really do in the same way.
Absolutely.
So I think it's working incredibly well, and it's, you know, it's really kind of very, very fun to see it unfold on our side.
Right.
So I mean, Andrew, for you and kind of along those same lines, you know, I know that when we initially talked, there was some thought about doing this in color and then, you know, kind of gone back to the more kind of grayscale approach. You know, one of the things I love that you're doing is kind of, it's got this kind of film overlay to the art. So it has like a real film grain to it. So it's taken on this very kind of cinematic black and white, you know, kind of feeling to the art. And I'd love for you to talk a little bit about kind of what some of the thought process was around that and what you're hoping people kind of take from that as a stylistic choice.
Uh-oh.
Or not.
Going connected it? Still, but
Andy?
It is saying connected, yeah.
Andy, did you hit the mute button, buddy?
Here, you guys pontificate for a second. I'm going to re-invite him in case he needs to jump back in.
All right. Anybody want to pontificate?
Actually, Jeff, I did want to ask you, we kind of got ahead of this, but I did want to ask you, you know, a little bit of your background as a writer. So you kind of went into production, but you've clearly, you know, you're clearly got skills in this arena. So, you know, what's some of that journey for you?
Oh, boy. It's one of those things, like I said, my life had a point where it really could have split. I was a English comm arts major at UW, University of Wisconsin-Madison. And, you know, there was the sort of two, because I've always, like, you know, the writing thing, I'll say what I think a lot of writers say, you don't necessarily like writing, you like having written.
Hello?
I always liked having written.
You guys are, hey, hello.
Yeah. But
hello,
the
sorry.
Writing part of it. Yeah.
Hello.
Andy, you're one.
He's back.
Missed you.
All right, we've gone back to Jeff. We'll circle back.
I'll make it super quick. So writing, yeah. So I was an English comm arts major. I decided to go into broadcasting just because it seemed way easier to get a job. Bottom line. So you know, the writing fiction, writing like that sort of thing. I do a lot of writing at my job, but it's the sort of thing where in 15 seconds, you know, try to get somebody to go to this particular spa as a, for instance, right. Or, you know, that sort of thing. So I've been writing, but like fiction, I did a fairly sizable project.
No, yeah. You're talking about the kids book?
That took us quite some time to finally reach the end. You know, so I'm talking about the kids book. And that was the first major long bit of fictional writing I had done really since college. And then this one, the difference I made when I committed to doing Dame Yaga is I committed that I was going to write, hey, everybody's busy, but I made the commitment I would dedicate one night every week to writing and working on it, which honestly is, you know, again, some people right now that are listening have like a good amount of free time, and they're like, one night? What do you like? You can't stop writing. You know, you can't stop watching whatever BS TV or. That's not my life.
Jeff, we talked about this. We said that you were going to do every night, skip dinners, things like that. We discussed this.
So that was the commitment I made, and that's the first time I've made that kind of like I'm going to do this kind of like really dedicated, really disciplined. And I also wanted to do it as absolutely well as I could, and that's something that I've really brought to it strongly. Like I want to do this as good as I can do at this particular junction in my life. Like. Full stop. And of course, everybody should do that. I mean, I'm not saying like I'm remarkable. Like, that's sort of like saying, and then I decided I'm going to breathe. So I took a deep breath and I blew it out, and by God, I breathed. There's sort of a baseline of what you would expect from anybody that's doing something. But like, that's part of the matter. But anyways, go to Andy because he's way funnier and more interesting.
I love that. And I want to underline just before we jump back to Andrew that it's like the what I love in what you said, and I think it's important for people of all kind of creative stripes, is the frequency I think is less important than consistency. And so, it's like whether it's one night a week or it's every morning or it's, whatever that is, that's actually workable. I think if you have the desire to make something, it's kind of amazing over a period of time of some level of consistency.
Yeah, just make up a program for yourself and to be able to stick to that, even if it's one paragraph a night. I mean, at the end of the month, you have 30 paragraphs, which is easily a chapter, which is then, it's just one step before the other. Adding to your point. So.
Yeah. Yeah, no, exactly. So I don't know where you dropped off, Andrew, but I was asking you. So it's like from the stylistic point of view, from the craft point of view on the art, I know we had talked early on about, the possibility of this being color, and then it's, the final execution of it is this kind of beautiful gray tone style. And then the thing I'm most interested in is, you've given it this kind of film grain overlay. So it's taken on the kind of a little bit of the effect of feeling like a movie that could be kind of from that era or from that time period. And so I'm just curious a little bit about your thought process there and kind of what the kind of journey to that point of kind of like, oh, this is how I want to do this. And then also,
vacillating between, is it going to be in black and white? Is it going to be in color? But I felt that color, I felt it would sell better as black and white, but I didn't want to go just black and white. So I wanted to add the gray tones to give it kind of some more of a meat to the characters, and to be able to, because if you have that extra dimension of tone that you can use to describe things, it can really go a long way. As far as the grain, it's something that I actually got from, I'm a big fan of animes visually. I don't actually watch a lot of anime, strangely enough, but I really do love manga and anime in terms of the visual presentation. Yeah. And that's something that they do a lot. And you'll notice like I'm using a lot of cel shading too on the characters. And I just feel it I'm almost embarrassed to say I don't have any other reason besides I just feel it looks cool. I mean, I really just like, I just love the way it looks. And I feel that it
does look
really
cool.
Is a versatile look. And when you put that sort of noise over everything, it's a very faint noise, but it has a way of sort of solidifying things. Cause if you just give like a flat solid tone, I find that, drawings like that, they have a tendency to just look a little flat and unfinished. If you just have a little noise, like it's interesting because I saw, saw something about Mobius on YouTube, and I showed him, it's one of the few clips of him drawing, and he was doing something on the computer, and I love Mobius. He is my favorite artist of all time. Like I've loved his work my whole life.
Yeah.
But seeing him work on a computer and seeing him use the color he uses, there was something off.
Yeah.
And I realized that, he doesn't have the grain of the paper. He doesn't have the imperfections of the watercolor. Mm. He doesn't have, that's kind of like part of what made his work volumetric and feel, and even though he might have been going for a super flat stylized style in some pieces, it still had the imperfections of that. And I feel like that's kind of why I did it. And yeah, that's basically why I do it. And like, and also there is just the cool factor, quote unquote. I just feel that anime, like particularly the Warner Brothers, it is an anime, but they use sort of like a sort of an anime style for a lot of their films. It just reads so nicely, and it reads like I love like good cell shading, and it works almost in pretty much every instance I've noticed. And also, you know, there is a desire to want to make every panel a painting, but there's also like a realism that where you have to admit like, well, you know, we can't render everything, you know, we have schedules and things like that, but it's a happy coincidence that the cooler look, in my opinion, is also the faster one. So, yeah.
Yeah, no, I think so. And I think, you know, I kind of love the fact that you did it because it looks cool. But I also think it really does. I mean, at least the way I perceive it is it also really does a great job of serving the story in the sense that, you know, it does kind of reinforce the feeling of the time period, the feeling of kind of the place. And it, you know, almost has a sort of newsreel you know, kind of element to it, which I think, you know, plays.
Well, and that's one of those, go ahead.
That
I was going to say, that's one of those happy accidents of like, you know, it also, it enforces the horror aspect of things. It enforces the, you know, spoiler alert, it's a horror story. it enforces the horror aspect, enforces the things like that. So,
Yeah, no, it really does. It works so nicely together. It's, you know, again, I think the combination of what you
have. Oh, thanks, man. I really appreciate it. Thank you.
So far, it just works. So, yeah, no, it's really cool. It's really, really cool.
Okay.
So I'm gonna turn this to us for a second, and I want to ask you guys. I mean, so you know, you delivered the assets and the art to us, and then you know, we did our kind of adaptation of it into the Macroverse format. So I'm curious, like, when you guys saw that for the first time, you know, what kind of reaction did you have, or did it deliver on what you hoped it would? Kind of just curious, kind of what that kind of slightly different version of.
This is going to get a little weird, but I actually I saw it on my phone, and I have an office chair that will swivel around. I started swiveling around and tapping my feet around. Well, I was, because I was so excited. I'm not even joking. I'm going to be honest. I'm just going to put it out there. That's exactly what I did, because, you know, I mean, you guys have to realize what started as a text conversation is now on an app, and someone I've never met is reading it at some point. You know what I mean? Like, it's like an idea that was in your head is now in someone else's head, and you didn't tell it to them.
Yeah.
If that makes sense. It's a really strange, like, it's just like, wow, this actually happened. And 100%. Like, someone knows who Elizabeth is now. Someone knows who, you know, and like Jeff has been a part of that, and it's just very cool. I was over the moon. I'll just put it that way. So I was very happy with it. So
I love it. Awesome.
And my reaction, same thing. I loved it. It's a really great reading experience. I loved the way that, you know, the, so to speak, the camera moves within his images. I think that's really lovely, the way that the captions would interact. That's one of those things where, you know, when I'm, you know, I've got the script, I'm looking at Andy's imagery, and that's one of the things that was sort of a challenge, is like, all right, how many words can I put here and make that it's all going to work? And it all just balanced so beautifully and really played off well. I was just, it knocked my socks. I was so happy to see that. And I'm looking forward to each of the next installments. I mean, it's, you know, as much, if not more, of a treat for me, just because, you know, I'm such a humongous fan of Andy's art.
What I really like is the words, like,
yeah.
It's not a static image. Like, the words can animate around the same image. You know, and so when, you know, we all have read those comics where you can tell the letterist is just like, how do I fit all of this in this panel? This is not going to work. But I, you know, and then they give it the college try. And then, but like with the app and the way things animate, it really, it's just very conducive to the story. And it helps move, it helps provide a sense of movement and progression as things are going, you know, as the story is going on. So I really like that aspect of it too. Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
Good.
Yes. Yep. And we're done.
Well, then we did what we wanted to do then. Good.
Big shout out to the letter or the person that did the captions, because I was quite specific about what I wanted from the captions. And it worked out. Now, well, it's important, especially when you have the voice of young Yaga. It was very important to me that you would know that this was an element of something that, it is a separate thing that is not part of the landscape. You're not overhearing something from off to the side, you know.
Yeah, and her narration works really well. And I think I was muted, was, you're talking about how she's a child. So I was going to say, like, it's almost like an abstraction to her. You know, like when you're 10 years old, if I pointed to you and said, someday you're going to be 40, like you'd say, that's never going to happen. You know, or like someday you're going to graduate from high school.
Yeah.
Whatever, you know, and then. But I think it works really, really well. And it adds to the creepy vibe, because she's talking about her own death in the sense of but as a child, and her mother is telling, you know, it works really well together. So,
yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we've been talking about all these different elements without kind of going back to square one. Okay. So let's do this here as we approach the end of our conversation. if you're telling someone that hasn't come across the series at this point, kind of a not necessarily kind of a pitch, but just sort of a brief of kind of like, oh, here's what this is.
I would say
here's why you should read it. What do you say?
The future of comics is on phones and tablets. I absolutely believe that. I mean, I love comic shops as much as the next guy, but I don't feel it's the future. And I will say, look, you can download it on your phone. You can read it right on your phone. Everyone has a smartphone. And I would just sell it as saying, like, look, it's super convenient. And if you like comics, you could do a lot worse than this. This is a really great app. So that came off wrong, saying you could do a lot worse than this. I'm going to say that came off really wrong. What I meant is this is a great app and it's got a lot of great stuff on it. So.
I think we should just take that as the new tagline. Macroverse, you could do a lot worse than this. And I appreciate that, but I phrased the question in the wrong way. I mean specifically about Dame Yaga as well. So it's like if you're bumping into something like, oh, what are you working on?
Gosh,
like, oh, I'm doing this thing
Jeff,
called Dame Yaga. What is it?
Okay, oh sure. So Dame Yaga, what I would tell somebody is Dame Yaga is it's two stories. It's a mother telling her daughter the story of her own impending death. And it is the story of a World War I ambulance driver who is finds herself in the middle of a world that has become incredible incredibly alien to her.
Netflix call.
Awesome. Netflix
call. Netflix, you get Netflix calls. You can do a lot of Yeah.
Yeah. You can do a lot worse. Yeah. I love it. Well, guys, I mean, we could not be more thrilled to have, you know, Dame Yaga be part of what we're up to with Macroverse. We love it. I mean, my favorite thing right now is, like, you know, when stuff like this comes in and, you know, we get to just kind of be a part of supporting and helping to realize these things in a way where it's no longer in your head or our head, it's in somebody else's head. it's so much fun. It's so awesome to, you know, kind of be a part of your own creative exploration and kind of putting this thing out in the world. And so we, you know, really just couldn't be happier and more thrilled to have it be part of this Macroverse experiment. And I think, you know, we all look forward to a lot more. And where, if people want to connect with you, you know, outside of this, where can people find you? Is there anything else you want people to know about, to kind of plug or to look at from you guys? Like, what do you want people to know as far as
in terms of artwork,
where to find you from
anything?
I'm pretty much on the usual. I'm on Art Station.
In terms of anything. So, yeah. So
I have an Instagram, things like that. I don't have the address of my Instagram at the moment, though. If you just Google my name on Twitter just search for my name on Art Station, excuse me, you can find my other artwork that I've been working on. It's mostly just like side stuff. But yeah, and you can send me a note. We'll talk, we'll chat, we'll do things like that. So
awesome. Jeff, are you a track downable at the moment?
You know, at the moment I am in seclusion. if you really want to get a sense for me on social media, follow CW14. Because that's where, like, honestly, I do a lot of that for my TV station. And, you know, I don't do a lot personally at this time. I am going to create a couple of different things because I do want to interact with fans for Dame Yaga. I should have done it by now. But every time I've been, I'm like, well, I could work on the story or I could do this thing. I'm going to work on the story at the time I have to do that. That's basically it. So that's where I've been with it. Again, you'd think with this, you'd think with the amount of spare time many, many people have right now that I'd be one of those people. And I'm just not. I just, you know. So, but that's where I'm at. What I'd really encourage is go check out other stuff of Andy's because, you know, he has such a tremendous range of style. It's just great stuff. So go look at Andy Traveled stuff.
Like, you know, actually,
you're going to enjoy that experience for sure.
You'll find Jeff's work on Macroverse. There you go.
Yeah, and check me out. Yeah, feel free.
And actually, come to think of it, when I was doing this like 2 years ago, I think I have Harpy at Dame Yaga on Twitter. I think I already did it because I think I was gonna tweet like start tweeting about the comic, and then, you know, and now we're here, so we might be able to just use that. So yeah,
there you go. That's that off. Yeah, there you go. Yeah. Awesome. Well, thank you guys so much. Great chatting with you. We'll do another one of these as we get a little farther into the series and we can, you know, talk more about kind of the specifics of what's happening in the story. But for anyone listening that hasn't yet read
now,
Dame Yaga on Macroverse, go do that now. right now, you can find more from us on especially Instagram at Macroverse Media. We're either that or at Macroverse pretty much on all the social media places. Of course, like and review and do all of that stuff, both for this podcast and also for the app itself. And most importantly, tell other people how cool it is. So that is, brings us kind of to the end of the episode. So again, awesome. Thank you guys.
Thanks for having us, dude.
So excited for
Thanks
more.
For joining.
And
cheers.
Come.
All right. Thank you so much.
We should all go wash our hands.